From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Everybody, to another episode of Goal Own Goal. Yes, it's that time again. I am joined, of course, by the man himself, in the lake, by the lake, near the lake, the author of Sports Perfect Storm, Roger Mitchell. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. But buzzing around a little bit. I don't think I'm going to get my golf.
Of course you are.
My golf six holes in today. I don't think it's going to happen. But I have got the clubs out again.
You're a published author now. You have to be running around.
Yeah, running around. But I did go to the range last week. I think it was Friday. And, you know, you get older, you can't move as much. You know, that's one of the things. And I tell you what, it's better. You know, the less moving parts, the better. It's now almost become like a fucking Neil Coles type swing. It's just all hands and wrist.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, mate. There's nothing wrong with that. I think this could be a start of an Indian summer for you on the golf course.
I'm telling you, it was hitting the ball really well. A little bit of a baby fade, Colin Montgomery, baby fade.
All right. Well, I feel a little rematch coming on in September.
Oh, we'll have to do it before that. I think we'll have to do it before that. Time's running short on you and I. We've got to make things happen.
Let's see how we go. Well, listen, my friend, I'm good. I'm in Cayman. I have my folks here. Shout out to my dad who listens to the show religiously. I'm recording this the day before they leave after 2 months in the Cayman Islands, escaping the French winter. So they're beginning to make their way back to France tomorrow. So we've had a fantastic time. I should be sad to see them go, but we've had some great fun together. So. Roger, let's get into it. I'm going to, as always, defer and let you go first. I'm sure you're going to pick at least one or maybe two of the things I want to talk about, but that's never a problem. What's your first goal and goal of the week?
Well, I'm going to go start with golf and just throw in a really, really nice early goal. Manacero, 10 years.
Ah, yes.
I mean...
I thought it was 11.
11, whatever it is, but geez, what a story that is. Obviously he's Italian here. When he broke out 11 years ago, he was, you know, here, the version of Tiger Woods. I think everybody really thought they were going to be a superstar, went into those doldrums that, you know, I think we're getting very familiar with now when we watch things like Full Swing. We can see people really in the doldrums. And he won. Yesterday he won on the DP World Tour. And, you know, amazing. I don't know more than that. I didn't see it, but I saw it on the timeline and I'm absolutely delighted. From all accounts, he's a splendid young man, from all accounts. So that's an early goal.
Yeah, I saw that too. And that was again, a tremendous story. And like you say, I've heard nothing but good things about him. It's funny. We should stick on golf.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because that was there's plenty to talk about in golf this week. And one of my goals was the second series of Full Swing, which I binge-watched. Remember binge-watching, Roger? That was a thing for a while, wasn't it? Until all these sneaky streamers started taking us back to 1980 and making us wait a week for an episode. I binge-watched Full Swing Series 2. And I have to say, it's a terrific show. I mean, it really is. I'm sure a big part of that is because I love my golf and I know the golfers, and so I'm a lot more engaged in it than I am in, for example, the tennis one. I can't even think what that's called. Breakpoint, is it?
Yes.
Match point, set point?
Breakpoint.
Something like that. Breakpoint, that's it. And there was so much in this series to talk about. And the thing I want to jump to first is... a source of permanent back and forth between you and I, and that was our friend from Hollywood, Northern Ireland, Mr. McIlroy. Obviously, he featured a lot in this episode, justifiably so, given what was happening in Liv and his role in it all last year. And you and I had a bit of a text back and forth on this earlier in the week, so I'm I've been looking forward to discussing it on the air. And I think what I'd like to do first, if I can, is bring you in as is the want these things, so you can offer the case for the prosecution, because I'm going to be defending him, and it's always the prosecution that goes first. So why don't you have at it and give me your thoughts on that?
Okay, well, I've only seen 3 episodes, right? So I haven't seen all of it, and he really mainly appears in episode 2, as far as I remember, when we're talking about the merger with Liv. So I've only seen 3. So if you've seen more and there's more stuff that he's involved in, you've got me at a disadvantage.
No. Really, after that, he's just in the Ryder Cup one, the two-part episode to finish it about the Ryder Cup. So.
Okay. Well, you know, context is everything, isn't it? You know, so Rory is an amazing case study here. You know, it must be nearly 4 or 5 years ago I came out with that bombastic claim that he would never win another major. And everybody thought it was crazy. And then I cashed out that bet. So I'm not taking any credit for the fact that he still isn't winning any other majors, but I'll just leave it there for the audience to remember that. It's 10 years or so or something. He hasn't won a major. And, you know, why? Why is that? He's clearly one of the very, very top guys, arguably the most talented golfer in the game these days, capable of doing things others aren't. My issue with Rory has always been what's in his head. I've got no issue with him as a golfer, as an achiever. I think there's something strange in his head. And when you see behind the scenes in the locker rooms and he's interacting, it does nothing but reinforce my view that he has never really grown out of his teenage years. I believe that he's immature. I don't know, I'm not a psychologist, right? But I've got a pretty decent idea of reading people. He strikes me as somebody that in some way personality wise has got an inferiority complex. When you compare him to the swaggering OK Corral gunslingers of Brooks and DJ, he looks, to use what I said to you on that tweet, he looks like what the kind of unlucky guy on the in-betweeners. He looks a little bit naive and a little bit out his depths with the big boys. And I just, when I was seeing him being there and commenting on Jay and, you know, feeling that he'd been the sacrificial lamb, it just reinforced that. Everybody could have seen this coming, everybody. And then all of a sudden he's on camera saying, oh, I've wasted a year, I don't care what they do now. And then Grant, you know, to yesterday or the day before, he's out there saying, oh, the PGA should only be about the top X players, the top 50 players, the top 100 players, which, you know, if I'm not mistaken, he was fundamentally, philosophically against all the way through in this PGA versus Liv thing. So I do see him as a guy that is in a world that is bigger than him personality-wise. I don't think he's got a big enough personality to do what his talent should allow him to do. I think when he was winning things, it was under the cover of being a teenager that nobody expected. But when he then got to that, I'm the man, I'm number one, I don't think his personality is big enough to walk the talk. That's best summary I've got, Grant, for the prosecution.
Well, look, I think that's a well-stated case, Roger, I have to say. And I can see, absolutely, watching it, not just on the Netflix, but watching his career, I can absolutely understand why you'd say that. And I'm not saying it's without merit at all. You know, I came away from the Full Swing stuff thinking very differently. To me, he was a guy, and we'll get back to that throwaway comment about the PGA Tour and the top 100 in a minute, because that's definitely something else to talk about while we're on golf. You know, I came away with a guy who is loyal, has principles, and I agree with you on the swagger. I think when he's in his pomp, when he's playing well, he has that swagger on the golf course for sure. When he's playing well, he swaggers like nobody. And I think that's what this is about. It's about the talent he has gives him that swagger, but he's not someone off the course who is necessarily, I don't think, comfortable in the public eye. I think if he could be without the public eye, he would be very, very happy to just get on quietly and play his golf. You know, you're never going to see, like we saw in series one of Full Swing, you're never going to see him showing off his boat by the water, you know, at his house in Florida. You're just not going to see him do that the way Brooks Koepka did. And, you know, here's my wife's closets and, you know, all these fancy houses and all that. You're just not going to see him do that because I just don't think it's his personality. He's a golfer, he's a husband, he's a father. And he carried the weight of the world on his shoulders. And I thought, the weight of the game on his shoulders. And I thought the most telling part of that was the way he handled what was, and let's use the word that a lot of people in the game use, betrayal of Jay Monahan. You know, Monahan betrayed him, betrayed everybody else in the game on the PGA Tour side. And McIlroy had every right to say, diplomatically, I thought, because I saw that press conference, that he felt, you know, a little bit like a sacrificial lamb, as what he said, very gently, right? Very gently. this is my secret agent days, Roger. You got to be able to mingle. But look, there was no doubt about how he felt. You could see that in his body language, in his eyes, in his voice. You could see that. But he didn't feel the need to throw Monahan under the bus. He didn't say, "Oh, but I back Jay unequivocally." It was clear that he'd felt betrayed. But he didn't want to create more strife for the game and have headlines about Rory tears, you know, Jay Monahan a new one. I think he handled himself with dignity and class. And to me, that loyalty, that dignity, that class, and that talent, that's what makes him, to quote the phrase that we were debating backs and forwards, a real man in the world of golf. I like I said, I think there's merit in what you say about DJ and Brooks not caring, but I, you know, they Brooks particularly just comes across as the bullying type. You know what I mean? The big guy in the playground who like swats everybody away, and maybe that's what you need to win. He's now won 5 majors, and Rory talks about this, and maybe you haven't seen this yet. His big problem with it all was there's someone in my era, and if you'd seen this,
I did see that bit, yeah.
And I would have thought that would change your mind because you could see how much he's like, no, there's someone in my era who's won more than me now. I'm not happy with that. That, to me, shows that he does have this inner fire to be the best golfer of his generation. And it'll be interesting to see this year what happens. I mean, I think if he can win the Masters and get that monkey off his back, win the career Grand Slam, which does make him the big boy of his era again because no one else in his era has done it. In fact, there's only 4 people who've done it in all of history. If he could win the Masters, I think you'd see him win 3 or 4 more majors
I agree with that. I agree with that. But this thing that we're agreeing on, you're just giving him a break for it. I can't because earlier as a younger man, he did something that, and you say it's not relevant, but for me, it all adds up.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know. It's always stuck in your craw.
No, I just think, you know, personalities and leopards don't change their spot. I think he's light. And the best I can give him as an excuse for that is immaturity. And what I'm saying is I don't think he's grown out of that immaturity. You know, the in life and certainly in elite sport, I believe you have to carry an element of menace. You have to carry an element of menace. You can hide it well. You can be smiling, but somewhere you have to have an element of edge. You know, Jock Steen had it, Shankly had it, Clough had it, Ali had it. You know, somewhere there's a... I don't see it with him when he's talking with these, you know, people in the dressing room, you know, I need to change something. Or even when he's putting on his trousers and his T-shirt, it doesn't give me an idea that he's going to go out there and claim something, you know? And again... there's a lot in this documentary, this docuseries about sports psychology. And I do believe that that is one of his problems. He doesn't know the man that he is in a world full of, you know, big swinging dicks. You know, what was that, the DJ joke, you know, with the journalist, you know, that was on Twitter, you know, what was that one? The girl, I'm called Rebecca, but you can call me Bex. He replies to her, I'm called Dustin, but
no,
you can...
my name's Dustin, but you can call me Dick.
Call me Dick. And she says, where does that, how does that come out? She
you've got to be very precise with the
right,
language.
Go.
She says, wait, how did you get Dick from Dustin? He winks right. And says, ask me nicely.
Yeah. Thank you for getting me out of a hole there. But you know, like, there's Christ, and then you think about him and Brooks and the rumours about their wives. I mean, like, I just don't see Rory in that kind of like big boys game. And golf at the end of the day is lonely. It's not a team sport, and the psychology is important. And what was it I said to you? He strikes me as the guy that, you know, gets distracted, and some of these big guys, all that you call the bullies, they steal his girlfriend and everything like that. I don't know what it is, and it sounds awful, this, but I've been proven right so far. He's got all the talent in the world, and for a decade, he hasn't won a major. There's something wrong there, Grant. There's something wrong.
Well, we'll see. I think he will win another major, maybe this year. And I think he stayed at the top of the game for those last 10 years. He's won a lot. He just hasn't won a major. Until he does, Rog, there is an asterisk, right? And what you say carries some weight. But I just think when you see him on the course, when you see him in the Ryder Cup episodes, which you will when you get to the end, there is, on the course, he's got all of that swagger and all of that strength and all of that menace and all of that bullying him. When you see him in that Ryder Cup, when you see the footage of him playing that Ryder Cup, and if you watched it live, you would have seen it. So we'll see. But it was fascinating. But let's stay on this and talk about that comment that you kind of threw in there about this top 100 guys. I didn't see Rory's comments. And I think with Rory's comments, him saying it, and as I said, I don't know exactly what he said. I've just seen the reporting of it. But if he did say it should be down to 100 guys, you know, that lands as hypocritical given his stance on LIV. But the one that was worse for me was the same comment made, I think, a day later by Wyndham Clark. And here's a guy who won twice last year. One of them happened to be the US Open, where he held off McIlroy, incidentally. But he's a guy who, until last year, probably wouldn't have been in that top 100. And that, to me, having made it that year into top 100 and saying, right, pull the ladder up behind me, I thought that. And again, look, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt because I didn't see the entire conversation, and often there are sensationalist headlines that try and take things out of context or whatever. But at face value, that to me looked way, way worse than Rory said. That's a real, you know, okay, I'm all right, Jack. Now I'm fine. Screw the rest of you. And, you know, it used to be us and them, and I was one of them, and now I'm one of us. Screw them, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've seen that in all my career in sport, which probably kind of like stains my view on everything. As I said earlier, you know, Super Leagues, in the 90s when England were doing it and then we did it ourselves. It is amazing how people change their view once they get the other side of the drawbridge. Without shame, it is amazing. And you know, to be, again, come to Rory, maybe I'm just, the best way to describe him is he's too nice for this world. Give him the best benefit of the doubt. This is a hypocritical world. This is a world where people seem, and G Monaghan, do you want to talk about him and what we saw in that documentary and his arse-looking staff?
Well, I was leaving
that
to you.
And his arse-looking staff. I mean, hopefully people will believe me, everything I've said for 5 years about what the governance of sport is all about. It's about this. You know, like, I wouldn't have been able to show my face after that merger. If I had to do the merger, I would have done it with Liv, and then the day after I would have said bye-bye. You know, this is the best I can do. It's time for somebody else. No. Out there, giving it large again, just beyond me, Grant. And this, this is the world that we live in. I mean, let's continue on a little bit of that, because we've got a lot of these own goal type things. One of them you mentioned to me during the week, or was it last week? Mason Greenwood. You know.
Yes.
So, no problem. Let's just bring him back. He's our saviour. I mean,
he's scored some cracking goals on social media recently. Let's bring him back.
So, it's hard to comment on what's right and what's wrong in sport when fans and commentators just and administrators just seem to have very little sense of right or wrong. You know, the other one I've got on this is obviously Formula One, which we can come back to if we want to talk about the sport itself. But, you know, this whole theme for how many years is it now? Diversity and, you know, inclusion and getting away from male toxicity all over the place. You know, and Formula One would argue that Drive to Survive, one of the big things it did was open it up beyond the petrol head, you know, cock heavy audience that motorsport used to be, the James Hunt crew. Comes to their first test. What do they do? He's still swanning around on the paddock. She's suspended for accusing him. Now, in what world is that acceptable? You know, I can be as like harsh as anybody sometimes, but sometimes I think I'm not harsh enough. How is that acceptable? That she's suspended, she seems to be the one that has to answer an accusation here, whilst he's there, you know, with his wife and, you know, everything's fine, and then Drive to Survive's on at the same time where he's lording it again and sacking young men on a whim and bringing other people back. Just hugely distasteful for me, Grant. Hugely distasteful.
Yeah, no, we can agree on this one, Rog. I've got no pushback against this one. You know, I saw that this woman had been suspended, I think yesterday or over the weekend sometime, certainly. And I was stunned that they would do that. I still don't know why, to be honest. She's been suspended. I have no idea why. I just saw that she was, and that part of the story hasn't come out, so I'm not quite sure what that's about. But even so, the quote unquote independent inquiry that cleared him was clearly okay, we need you to do an independent inquiry, and we need you to find a way to clear him. You know, it's one of those independent inquiries, right? And look, from a business standpoint, I get why it's important for Red Bull to have him there. He is such a big part of that team, and that team has been a successful team. I suspect had they taken an extra half an hour to say, okay, Max, Joss, if we do this, is this a good thing for Red Bull? If we clear him, are we good? Is this going to... Because I think if they'd have known the response they'd get from first Jos Verstappen, who is not without foibles of his own, Rog, let's be clear. But if they'd have seen the turmoil that decision would cause within their team, I suspect they would have gone differently. Because at the end of the day, Horner's been a very successful team principal for them. But we all know it's the engineers and the cars that are the important thing, and the driver in Verstappen, although I think you could put any decent driver in one of those cars and have a fair crack at it. And the fact that they've either suspended Helmut Marko, who's the chief engineer, I guess, because he talked to the press. The team's in chaos, Rog, which is fascinating to watch. And you know, for me, the funniest part about it is watching the glee with which Toto Wolff keeps saying, well, you know, we need more insight into what's going on. He's just having a field day stirring the pot for this thing. And I don't know whether and how much of this makes it into the next season of Drive to Survive. But Netflix must be rubbing their hands here with all the cameras around the paddock this last couple of weeks, going, oh, boys, how do we rush season 7 out? Because this is going to be an absolute barn burner. So, I think it's gone.
Did you see it this year, the documentary, Drive to Survive?
Do you know, Rog, funny enough, I watched the first three and then I'm, you know, I think I will probably go back and watch the rest. I'll probably watch the rest, maybe. But
maybe
the previous seasons, I've watched them all straight through.
There you go. There's your signal. There's why you might not have a season.
No, absolutely.
You might not have a season seven. I think it's a sport. I think it's a sport that's in trouble for a lot of reasons. It's got so much going for it, but yeah, okay, you can say it's just the way the cycles go. It was the same with Schumacher and Ferrari were winning. It was the same with Lewis and Mercedes were winning. Nobody likes this, the processions. You know, frankly, a race finishes as soon as he gets to the first corner and away. You know, Verstappen, the race is over. And that's not good. So, you know, you can't sell it on, you know, who's going to be doing better in mid-table. You can't sell it on that. You know, you just can't sell. And you know, there's a thing that you know, it was one of the really interesting ones was the McLaren one episode with Zak Brown, who I quite like Zak Brown. I certainly like Lando Norris and Piastri. I like that. But, you know, Zak Brown came out, not on the documentary, but this week he said, every single F1 team now is worth at least £1 million.
Billion pounds.
And in the past, it wasn't that. You couldn't give them away because they all were losing money. And he was making the fact that it's due to the fact that there's budget restrictions, budget caps that build in that.
Yep, I thought you would have read this.
You know, no shit, Sherlock. When is football and rugby going to get this message? You want to drive up the value of your franchises? Stop trying to throw more product in. Stop trying to sell more widgets. Just control the costs. That's how you put the value on. I got this quote from Jerry that I put in the article, Jerry Cardinale, I put in Sunday's article. Where is it? Where it's just such a magnificent quote where he's saying, we need to stop valuing this stuff on revenues. We can do better than that. That's just lazy. We need to value it on future cash flows. And he's absolutely right.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? But that's not the way the world's worked for 20 years. And that's why there is this link between the capital markets and sport, because capital markets, VC, have valued things on per user, on growing your top line, on exponential growth. And at the end of the day, it's value about between 7 and 10 times cash flow. And that's where your major valuation is. So I'm always super curious what's going to happen with football, because whilst Jerry is out there, you know, singing the good song, you got guys like Texter who at the same FT conference said, let's just let everybody spend what they want so we can catch up with the big guys. Fine. There's no profitability in the industry then. I don't get it, Grant. I mean, maybe I'm too close to it. I don't get this. I don't get what they're trying to do, these people.
I don't either. And you've been making this point throughout the lifespan of Are You Not Entertainment, Roger, about the salary cap. And it's absolutely right? You're paying all this money away to players and agents. It's been an arms race, but it's been an arms race as we've banged on about until I'm bored of it. So I'm sure the listeners are, in which case I apologise. But the change that happened when interest rates started going up was always going to be profound. And there wouldn't have been any of this navel-gazing that you just read out there. If capital was still free, there wouldn't have been any of it. You know, Zak Brown wouldn't have said that. They wouldn't have had to focus on costs. I don't know. We can see the wind has shifted. We can see things are changing. I think it's a long way for football to start cutting player costs. But you know, if you think how quickly the Bosman ruling changed football back in the 80s or late 80s, early 90s. You know, I suspect, Rog, if things stay the way they are, and I have no reason to doubt that they will or get worse in terms of affordability, in terms of, you know, fan free cash flow, if you like, I want to put it in semi-financial terms, I have no doubt that the watershed will come and someone will be forced into doing it. And if they're smart, they will spin it the right way. It's a really easy spin, right? If you're a PR guy and some club says to you, hey, listen, we've got to cut our wages, we've got to cut the cost, but how do we spin this message for the fans? I mean, you'd rub your hands in glee. I mean, talk about an easy sell, right? Our fans, you know, it's our club, we've got to protect it for the future, and we know it's going to be tough, but we know you'll be behind us, blah, 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 blah. We want to reclaim our club from the cutthroat mercenary. I mean, it's the easiest spin in the world. And I think you're right. I think it'll happen. I think it may take a fair while before it does, but I think when it does, it'll happen fast. Just like the Bosman rule changed everything. I think once these dominoes start falling, they'll change everything. And the clubs that don't do it, the Man Cities, the ones financed by nation states, will quickly become absolute pariahs in the game. Even more so perhaps than they are now to some people. So I hope you're right, and I hope it happens sooner rather than later, but I fear it will be later.
Yeah, I mean, there was this thing in the FT today, a big Bain report. The headline was, you know, private equity's never had so many unsold, unsellable assets on its books.
Yeah, shock horror.
Well, but I'm telling you, Grant, it's you know this, but other people don't. Other people don't. Other people have got very little understanding of private equity. And you know, I just wonder when this is all going to unravel, because, you know, let's take the French League deal. I think that's a CVC deal with the French League for their media rights. The French League are, you know, I don't know, 6 months overdue announcing their new TV deal, on which that private equity deal is based. Now, there's only one bidder for the French League, you know, and DAZN themselves have got their own issues. DAZN clearly have got a better understanding of the real value of these rights now compared to maybe when they were in a more bullish phase of growth 18 months ago. You know, they dropped their bid in Italy. They're not going to bid high in France. Nobody else is in the market in France. The rights absolutely are going to come down. I hear Macron is getting involved, you know, because obviously, you know, it always becomes political. But all these things are going to have to happen.
Macron's the worst. Macron is just the worst. Don't get me started on that guy.
I know. Well, Trudeau beats him, I think, in a lot of stuff.
Well, actually, you're right. That's right. I mean, Trudeau's out on his own. Macron's the worst of the rest.
Yeah. So, listen, you know, the thing about private equity, the question is, how do all the bad deals that they have done, and they're not all bad, some of them are very smart, but how have all the bad deals they've done going to unravel, and how is it going to affect?
I've got two words for you, Rog.
Yeah.
I've got two words for you. Continuation fund.
Okay, yeah, I know that, you know, that's my favourite phrase these days, but really, do you think they'll get away with that?
They have been. I mean, they won't forever. Of course they won't. But listen, while they still can, they will. That's how it works, right? We sell them to ourselves and we start a new fund with them in, and you know how the game works, right? It doesn't.
I know.
And your point is right, though, Roger. So few people understand this. That's why they get away with it.
Well, hopefully they understand it a little bit better after some of the stuff that we've put out. Not just me, but also you, Grant, because there's a lot of the sports industry that follows you now and subscribes. And, you know, again, what's happened in the commercial property space and how that is unravelling is...
Well, is there any chance any of them could come to Fulham and get the numbers up? Roger, listen, let's switch tacks. I want to bring the subject to boxing. For an own goal, which I admit has the potential to be a huge, huge, massive goal. In fact,
Tell me why you think it's a huge goal, because you should hate this product, but you don't.
No, I said it has the potential to be a goal. There's only one way this can be a huge goal, and I'll explain that in a second. But yes, I'm obviously talking about Mike Tyson fighting whichever one of the Pauls.
Jake,
I don't know.
Jake.
Yeah, Jake. Okay, whatever. I don't care about either of them. I saw the announcement and my heart sank initially. My heart sank just as like, oh God, really? Are we now? I should say that I love Rafael Nadal. I love Carlos Alcaraz. I have no interest in that Netflix thing, the fake, you know, whatever thing was they put together. No. No interest, and I didn't even watch it because it was not like I had to watch it live. It's on Netflix. I think it keeps showing up in my, you know, For You or whatever it is. It's not even crossed my mind to watch it, right? I just have zero interest in it.
But can I do a parenthesis on this, because it's super key, this one, before you both come back to Tyson. So I didn't watch it live. I watched it because I'm in the industry, because we do podcasts like this, and because it's part of a bigger theme that your own goal here is going to allow us to talk about. So I watched this, right? It's glitzed up in the way that we wouldn't like. You know, there is a high energy OMG, you know, kind of like attitude of the presenters. Even, you know, they had Agassi, they had Roddick, and some other guy who was a tennis commentator in the States, and they were all high revs. High rev, isn't this amazing? You know, so that kind of like put us off. It was the opposite of Dan Maskell, right? So, you know, everybody will understand what I mean by that. The absolute opposite. And like, whilst I like a little bit of razzmatazz, it really put me off. And, you know, and it gets worse, Grant. It gets worse. You know, they do the big kind of like walk-ons and, you know, the presentations, fair enough. And, you know, the game's going on, and then in the breaks, you won't believe this, during the game, in the breaks, a woman, I think she's an ex-player, Mary Jo, something like that, I don't know who she is.
Fernandez, Mary Jo Fernandez.
Could be, yeah. She sits down beside them with a microphone on their seat. How you doing, Rafael? How you doing? You're 5-2 up in the first set. You think you can close out the set? Seriously, Grant?
No, but that's it, Rog. It's not serious. That's the whole point of this, right? You are taking two serious sportsmen and a game that for their entire lives has been incredibly serious to them, and you are trivializing it. And you're taking away the gravitas of it, and you are taking away the work and what it means to them, right? Because it does mean to them. I don't care if it was an exhibition and they might have been having fun, but you know deep down, neither of them wanted to lose that, right? They wanted to win it. Even if they didn't play that way, even if it was a bit goofy and a bit, you know that at the end of the day, neither of them wanted to lose that. If it came down to, and I don't know what happened, I've got no idea what happened. If it came down to a tiebreak to win it, they would have both tried everything to win that game. It wouldn't have been jokey. And if, I don't know if you saw any of that hybrid full swing drive to survive Formula One players.
I'm coming on to that in a minute. It's all linked.
Let me leave you the floor then to get to that.
Well, so, you know, Nadal wins the first set. Alcaraz wins the second. Again, he's interviewed whilst he's winning the second set. And this is the thing. I wasn't watching it live, and I was on Netflix forgetting the game and getting to where I saw on the thumbnails something different happening, like an interview, like, you know, Agassi was coming on, or what clearly was, you know, an important point. So I was definitely skim reading the whole experience. And then I saw that he got to one set each, and the third set starts. And I start going ahead again. And then I see something strange happen. It says match point. And I thought, how can it be match point? So anyway, apparently, I think I worked this out. The third set goes directly to a tiebreak. It is only a tiebreak, but it's first to 10 points. And like, I took a little bit of while to work that out. If that's wrong, forgive me, but I think that's the case. And then to your point, Grant, this was beautiful, right? So Alcaraz has got 4 or 5 match points on this tiebreak. And one of the ones that Nadal saves is with one of those astonishing passing shots that has got a 1 in 10 chance of actually finding the little square inch of court that's available to him. And you get that emotion. Oh, wow. And you could see everybody in the crowd. Wow. You know, it was classic Nadal up against it, and he pulls this out. Okay. Alcaraz then wins a little bit later on. There was about 7 match points. And that's the end of it. And I stopped. You know, I certainly wasn't going to hang on till the, you know, the after-match commentary. But why would you hang on for that? Why would you possibly wait to hear what Andy Roddick's going to say about this game? But, you know, I'm going to leave you, Tyson, but I'm going to stay on this thing about what Netflix are doing. And you're absolutely right. What they're doing with all of this is they're testing. They're testing how sport fits into their broadcast business model. You know, they do Drive to Survive. And, you know, people should not think that these are standalone pieces of content. That then leads into the Golf Pro-Am, you know, which you saw with the drivers, which was truly awful.
No, no, I saw 2 minutes, three. I physically couldn't take it.
That's all you need to see.
I mean, it was like being waterboarded for me. Yeah.
Right, so you've got Breakpoint and...
Sporterboarded. Let's call it. I was sporterboarded.
Breakpoint leads into this, just the one we've talked about, Nadal Alcaraz. And you know, they also did Jake Paul Untold, a little documentary about this guy. Then that leads on to this fight. You know, these people are smart. They're not just throwing mud at the wall willy-nilly. What they are doing is working out how sport gets new subscribers, keeps them, and stops churn. And they're testing. You know, on the Tyson fight, you know, you would say, well, why aren't they putting it behind pay-per-view? Why aren't they putting it pay-per-view? Well, there's a whole lot of reasons that DAZN probably don't want it. They've never really liked this old man, young man thing. It's not real. And they're more in with the kind of like KSI type stuff. You could say that DAZN weren't that interested in this fight, but Netflix will probably drop, I don't know, what would they have to pay these guys? 25 million, you know, for this event. It's just, it's market research budget, Grant. Netflix is using the industry of sport to see how it fits into their subscription model for entertainment. Now, you can take a view on that and say that's so sad, or you can say that's smart. You know, it's probably both. But that's how we got here. What it means for boxing, I'll leave it, take it back to you. But that's what Netflix are doing. They are testing out the market.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I can see that happening almost in real time. But if you want to, look, it's very simple, right? If you want to know how to make money out of sport, buy the rights to the NFL. There you go. Buy the rights to the Premier League. There you go. And we'll talk about the Premier League shortly for sure. But this, you know, this Tyson, you say it was Jake? Logan?
Jake Paul.
Yeah, this fight, Tyson's 57. I think Jake Paul's got 30 years on him, right? So I mean, it's farcical at best, right? I remember in Tyson's pomp, and his pomp was unlike the pomp of any other heavyweight, with the possible exception of Ali. But it was a very different type of pomp. Yeah, yeah, exactly right. He went in that ring knowing that I can kill this guy legally, and I'm going to try and do it. You're absolutely right. But there were two things outside the ring that I remember from the 80s that were a big part of Tyson. There was the, you know, he was obviously the orphan that Customato and his wife had taken in and brought up, and he loved his racing pigeons, right? He kept these pigeons, and he was this soft-spoken kid, orphan from Brooklyn, and had the pigeons. But the other thing was his encyclopedic knowledge of boxing. And he had a reverence for boxing when he was that age, which was far beyond his years. You know, he was a 19-year-old kid, but the gravitas that boxing held for him, he knew everything about every great heavyweight he'd ever fought. You could tell that he had a reverence for the sport, a true reverence for the sport. And when I saw this fight get announced, like you with Rory, whatever it is, there was a part of me, a little part of me that died, thinking, okay, Tyson's moved on from his reverence of boxing. He's now thinking, I can get 25 million bucks here. I'm a stand-up comedian. And I saw his one-man show. It was superb. And a little part of me died. And then I thought to myself, you know what? There is a way this could be. This could be solid gold.
Yes, yes.
He could get in the ring and finally beat the living bejesus out of Jake Paul and end this complete nonsense once and for all. Now, the cynic in me says that there will be all kinds of agreements in place saying, listen, Mike, if you've got him on the ropes, you know, just go easy on him, right? We don't want you to hurt the guy. Because, I mean, you like me, I know we shared this a few months ago, the footage of Tyson sparring at 57. I mean, holy Jesus.
Avoid now, at all
it's
costs.
Very different. It's very avoid different. It's very costs. Different to spar for a few minutes and have a boxing match. I understand that, right? But there is a chance that Mike Tyson could do the world of boxing a great favor, could get in that ring, suddenly remember his reverence for boxing, suddenly remember the menace he carries, and end this pro-celebrity nonsense once and for all by showing that putting people in the ring who have no right to be in the ring. I wish Tyson was 20 years younger, Rog, I really do. But and again, honestly, I won't watch it. I will see
you
the headlines.
Won't watch
and if
it, you won't watch it.
No, I won't watch it when it. I won't put it in my diary and say watch it when it's on.
Oh man,
I'm saying if I read the coverage that says Mike Tyson knocked out Jake Paul, you know, in 25 seconds, I will then go to Netflix and say, oh, I'll watch that. But I thought about it. I won't sit down and go, oh, I can't wait for Saturday night and watch Tyson Jake Paul. I have no interest in it other than if its outcome is what I want to happen, and then I'll give it the time to watch it, and I will fast forward all the bullshit. I will get to the bell ringing in the first round, and I'll watch it. You know, fast forwarding between rounds because I just don't care for all. I don't care about it in any way, shape, or form unless Tyson raises the question, should we be doing this anymore? And then I'm interested because the answer's no.
Yeah. Listen, I think I could have a good go to try and convince you on this because you're right. I mean, everything you're saying is correct, but it's in the presentation, isn't it? Like so many things in life, that anticipation is better than the actual event. So let's just think about this. This Mike Tyson, everything that you said there is correct. Customato. You know, then you start thinking, Tyson, in recent years, 90% of the time is stoned out his head, right? The shrooms are there. He is stoned out his head. And every so often he does an interview where he starts crying and he says, I became a man that I didn't know, the monster, you know, this monster scares me, the monster, don't let the monster back. The anticipation of this fight is that all the deals are done. You know, if you get him on the ropes, you let him off, you don't keep going, here's the thing to sign, and Tyson can't hold to that. He can't hold
right,
to
right.
that.
The bell goes,
fucking
it's 1987,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, you're not wanting to be there in that moment live when you see the monster come back. You wouldn't want to be there live.
Rog, listen, what I'm saying to you is if I'm sitting at home that night, putting the TV on and go, the Tyson fight's on. I will not set a reminder on my phone to remind me that Tyson's fighting that thing. It'll flash up in Twitter if he beats it, and I'll go onto Netflix and
You and I are different because, like, there's that thing about the menace that I said earlier. Menace is beautiful. You know, the menace is there. Is it there? Is it not there? Is it dead? Is it alive? Can it spring back? That's a beautiful promo. It really is.
Roger, I agree. But you, like me, were the perfect age when Tyson was Tyson, right? And I remember those title fights. I remember when he won the title from Burbick, the excitement, the staying up till 1 a.m. to watch the fight. I remember all that, right? Every single fight he had was box office, right? I remember the Leon Spinks fight. I remember watching that in a hotel room in Tokyo during our lunch break when I was living out in Japan. I remember me and about 20 Swiss guys sitting around the TV in someone's room because that was the only way we could watch it with, you know, room service and burgers and fries and stuff. I remember every single one of those fights. Every single one of them was, you cannot miss this fight. It's Tyson. And so to me, having seen that and having witnessed that and having felt that menace, felt when it was real, when the menace was real, when the boxing was real, this is not real to me, Rog. It's not real. I don't care about sport that isn't authentic. This has been my my stance from day one in this.
I know that.
If it's not authentic, if it's not real, I don't care about it. And there's no amount of hype that is going to make me anything above mildly curious.
Right. Let's try and rationalize this out in finance terms, right? there is a 50-50 chance. If I put it to this like this to you, there's a 50-50 chance that he does to Jake Paul what he did to Marvis Frazier. I mean, it's that brutal, you know? There's a 50-50 chance of that. You're telling me you would still not tune in at round one, ding, ding, to see that live?
No, I'm not saying I wouldn't. I'm saying I wouldn't go out my way to. I say if I'm home, it's on.
I'm saying putting it in your diary with an alarm because you don't want to miss the chance. Oh, well, see, that we're different.
No, because I won't miss it. I won't miss it, Rog. I won't miss it.
You miss it live. You miss it live.
I don't care. I don't care. But that's my point. I would never have missed Tyson live when it was real. When it was real. When he was fighting for the heavyweight title of the world against this procession of people who thought they could take the baddest man on the planet down, I wouldn't have missed it. I would and did get up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It was unmissable.
It was unmissable.
Unmissable.
This is not unmissable because it'll be on Netflix 20 minutes later, surrounded by a load of pap. It's just not real, Rog. Here's the chance I don't want to take, right? By giving up my time to watch it, which I would never have said in Tyson's heyday. The chance I don't want to take is I sit there through three rounds of them not really holding, trying to hurt each other.
Holding, yeah.
Right? Three rounds of Tyson, we don't want you to kill this guy. There's 25 million in it for you. We don't want you to kill him. And Jake Paul, showboating. And I don't want to waste giving up 9 minutes of my life for that, Rog, because that will tarnish the Tyson legacy in my mind, which is, despite all his human foibles as a boxer, as a sportsman, as an icon of his era, he's one of the most impressive athletes I've ever seen in my entire life.
Ever.
At his peak, he was unbeatable until he got beaten. Right. And that
was a woman's fault. We need to say that. That was a woman's fault. Let's be honest. He was great until she got in the picture.
Robin Givens,
let's not forget
that. Rog, hey, listen, to this day, that's the biggest bet I've ever won is when I backed Buster Douglas to beat him.
You're
in that
joking.
Fight. I was living, I've not told you the story. I was living in Japan and the fight was in Tokyo at the Tokyo Dome. And myself and some buddies of mine, Mark Ellswood, Kevin Bilsby, shout out if you're listening. They had an open sparring session a few days before the fight. And I was flying to America. I wasn't going to be in Japan for the fight. All my mates were going to the fight and I couldn't be there. I was going there on business and I was going to go while I was there to the NBA All-Star game in Miami. This was 1990, if I remember rightly. So we went to this final open sparring session and Tyson comes out and we were two rows from the front of the ring in a tiny little gym, right? So he was 8 feet away from me, 10 feet away from me, right? And he came out for his session and he had his gloves up to his face like this, right? And he was walking around the ring and his coach, Kevin Rooney, well done, was literally walking next to him and his arm on his shoulders, whispering in his ears, and he just walked around the ring like this. The sparring partner came in and he threw some punches and you were like, in awe at the speed, but he punched for a bit and then went away and had his gloves up over his eyes. And you could just tell something was off with him. You could just see it in his body language. It just, I don't know, something was wrong. I'd never been to a sparring session in my life. He goes off, leaves, and it's all very disappointing. Like, we didn't really see him box much. It was like short 5-second burst against a sparring partner. And off he goes. And in the corner while he's sparring, there's this guy skipping rope who was the biggest human being I've ever seen. This guy was massive. He was just muscle upon muscle upon muscle. And he's just quietly skipping rope in the corner. Tyson goes away. 20 minutes later, half an hour later, Buster Douglas comes out. None of us knew who Buster Douglas was, right? None of us had any idea who he was. And our memory of Buster Douglas now is this big, fat, overweight guy on his Harley, you know, after he'd made it. But back then, he wasn't cut, but he was in shape, right? He comes into the ring, and they send in a procession of sparring partners, and he proceeds to rip the head off every single one of them. I mean, he tears into these guys, Rog, like with a ferocity that could only come from someone that knew this was his chance, right? This is my chance. And they were carrying sparring partners out on a conveyor belt out of this ring. It was impressive to watch. I didn't have any frame of reference, right? I didn't have any, but I'd seen Tyson, I'd seen Douglas. And we all looked at each other and went, I mean, yeah, it could be nonsense. Who knows? Tyson's just not bothered at the sparring, maybe. But we all had a bet on Buster Douglas, and the odds, I forget what the odds were, but they were, you know, 30s to 1. I mean, well, it was crazy. That I forget the odds
But
now.
He did get counted out. He did get counted out, and they let him keep going on.
There was all the controversy.
He was counted out.
Lawsuits. And lawsuits glorious. Flew for Don King for months after this, right? But I went to the slam dunk competition at the All-Star game in Miami. This was back when the slam dunk competition was...
What a life you led, Grant, eh? What a life. Single man investment banker.
No, but do you know what, Roger? So this is the funny part. I went and scalped two tickets to the All-Star game on the Sunday, right? And I got two tickets to the All-Star game and I got one ticket to the slam dunk competition. And the slam dunk competition was a big deal back then. You know, Jordan had appeared in it a couple of years ago. This was the year Dee Brown won it with his Reebok pumps by pumping up his sneakers before he went and did the winning dunk. It was real. Again, there was an authenticity to it, right? But I bought two tickets to the All-Star game. They came as a pair and I got great seats, like two rows behind the Western Conference bench. And I paid a lot of money for these two tickets, but I then managed to sell one of them to a scalper for what I paid for the two on the day of the... And look, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, this was peak NBA, Dominique Wilkins, the benches were stacked, yeah. So I actually ended up doing the whole thing for free, which is great, but I digress. So when I went to the slam dunk competition on the Saturday night, on the seat, everyone had a sign... You know, a little like you hold up at games, right? And it was sponsored by Gatorade, who sponsored the slam dunk. On the one side, it had a 9, on the other side, it had a 10, so that the crowd could grade the dunks, right? Just like the judges did. So I had one of these things as a souvenir. I took my thing out, I had 9 and 10, and I leave, and I'm going to meet a mate of mine who lives in Miami in a bar, and I'm in the line to get into this bar. You can tell how long ago it was. I went to a bar, Roger, after 8 o'clock at night. And I'm in the queue to get in this bar, and there's a guy on the door checking IDs, right? And he's got one of these 9, 10 things, right? Someone's obviously given him from the fight. And as he's letting all the women in, as they're walking in, he's holding up either the 9 or the 10, right? For the women as they've gone past him, right? All very perfect. Funny, all very 90s. Anyway, 90s. I get to the front and I show my ID. And at the time, I was 23. I had to be 21 to drink. So I had to show my ID back then, Rog. And I have a joke with him about the 9 and the 10. And he says, 10. He says, that's my new favorite number. I said, why is that? He said, that's the round Tyson got knocked on his ass. Because I had no phone, I had no social media. I was like, wait, what? Oh. I said, Tyson, Tyson lost. He said, yeah, Buster Douglas knocked him out. And I was like, wait a minute, I've made how many thousands of dollars? This is the greatest weekend of all time.
That's a great story.
But a very long story. But
so like you went into the bar and you met Winona Ryder. That's the end of the story.
Oh, Rog, do you know what? I wish I lived the life you think I live. I really do.
That is the life. You get two tickets, you punt one off, you lay off the trades. You black your way into the bar with this 9-10 thing, and then you meet Winona Ryder.
The funniest part is on the afternoon of the All-Star game, I'm sitting there at my thing, and I've still got the photo somewhere. I'm 10 feet from Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. They're all sitting right in front of me, right? Of course, what you don't think about is during the game, you can barely see anything because it's so fucking tall.
It's so tall.
But I wait. And right before the game starts, this guy comes down and sits in the seat next to me, right? And I'm desperate to ask him what he paid for that ticket because I know what I sold it for and I know there's a markup and I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I don't know why. I should have done. But I have no idea the increase in those price. Anyway, where were we before I got sidetracked?
That's great. Tyson, boxing. The chance that he does to him like he did to Marvis Fraser, is too tempting for me. It's too tempting for me.
It's not enough for me to change my plans.
No, well, yeah, you're wrong. It could be the moment that he just wakes, like you say, for a second and just goes berserk, and that would be golden.
But how are you going to feel? How are you going to feel if it's a three-round nonsense or if Jake Paul gets a lucky punch and knocks him down?
That's not going to happen.
How are you going to feel?
He's not going to knock
him down. No, how are you going to feel?
Bad. Bad. Very bad.
I don't want to see it. But this is my point. I don't want to see it, Rog. I don't want to see it. I don't want to see a circus involving one of the greatest heavyweight champions of all time, the greatest champion I've ever seen in my life. I don't want to see him in the middle of a circus. And if the result is something I want to see, I'll watch it. But I don't want... I saw that Robin Givens interview. Right, I don't want to see him parade in the ring and just use to sell. It's too much for me. Too much.
I know, I get that. Anyway. Maybe you convinced me. Anyway, this is all leading up to KSI and Jake, and then that is the end of the celebrity boxing thing, which we've been saying for a while. And it just all leading up to this one last thing. Let's hope so. All good.
We're going long this week, but we haven't got. Yeah, of course I've got something else, and you know what it is. We're going to talk about the Premier League, because we have to, right? And I'll save Luke Littler for another week.
Nine darter.
The
amazing
game yesterday, Man City, yeah. Liverpool, Man City. You and I were texting sporadically during that game, only sporadically because it was just, I couldn't take my eyes off it to even text you. Wow. What an advert for the Premier League that was, Rog. That was football at its finest. Two superb teams going all out at each other with skill and pace and strength and tactics. It doesn't get any better than that. I really don't think it gets any better than that. And I'm going to leave you to say what I know you're going to say about it. And we'll talk about that. But that, to me, that's what sport is. That's what sport is. It meant something to the players. It meant something to the managers. It meant everything to the fans. And they performed at their highest level. No one tried to stifle the game. Both teams wanted to win it because they neither had to because of Arsenal, right? They both had to win it. It had controversy. It had skill. It had pace. It was breathtaking, Rog. That, to me, is everything that sport is about. Everything that sport is about. And I loved every minute of that.
Well, that's a great advert for the EPL, which I think is in need a little bit of some good news these days. It is off the field struggling a little bit and clubs bouncing off the walls and court cases and everything like that. Yeah, I was up for that game as well. I also watched Villa-Tottenham earlier, which was good as well. It's just funny, isn't it? You know, this testosterone thing. John McGinn, you know, like out of nowhere, just decides to have a whack. I mean, like, insane, but in many ways...
Where's he from, Rog? John McGinn, where's he from?
He's from Paisley. He's from where I'm from.
Oh, is he? Oh. I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, like... You know, listen, I thought Villa were very unlucky. It just shows you how funny it is. You know, Tottenham, what did they win, 4-0 at the end? That was never a 4-0 game. You know, I think Tottenham were holding on, and just shows you how strange it is. But anyway, coming back to the Anfield game, the first 10 minutes, I thought City were playing a level of football that was just unbelievable.
Oh, untouchable. Sorry to interrupt you, and I've talked a lot this episode, which I hate doing, but
no,
you've got me all fired up. But I want to go back to before the game. Let's talk about that atmosphere. Let's talk about You'll Never Walk Alone. Let's talk about the chills it gives you seeing how much it means to those fans, seeing the crackling intensity of something like that, the build-up to it. I mean, it is... I was sitting with my dad, and my dad says, God, it just brings a tear to your eye watching that. I mean, there's something so powerful about these stadiums on these big occasions. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to describe unless you've experienced it. But the TV does such a good job of giving you a sense of it. It's, you could tell from that, the emotion, everything was there for that to be a good game. And sometimes you go, please don't disappoint me. But as you say, so sorry, go back to that first 10 minutes.
No, you're right. The atmosphere, you know, what they call these days the jeopardy, and how that translates to the fans. And, you know, I did that whole thing about the Angel and North London Forever, and, you know,
yes, the article. Yes, yes, yes.
You know, I get that completely, and I think that is absolutely the core of it all, and the complete difference to some of the things we've seen on this episode. So it starts off, and you look at the lineup for City, and they've got all their players in the front six. All the really good players, and, you know, they're switching it around with pace, and Foden is on fire, absolutely on fire. And you know, I was watching it with the Italian commentary, Paolo Di Canio, who is a guy that really gets excited. You know, like, he doesn't leave the comments half yeah, half right. delivered. You can imagine he gets really, really excited. And the hyperbole is off the scale, and it's so funny. You know, you know all this whole stuff about the Romans. He's a crazy guy. He had to get banned from Sky Italy for a while for the you know, the fascist salute, because he likes Mussolini and everything like that. But yes, as a comment, yes. You know, like, he is not a plain vanilla
in
bloke.
In Italy.
He's not a plain vanilla bloke. And his commentary in this first 10 minutes was out of this world. Out of this world, you know, like, because he was a player and he loves the game, and he was right into the way you were. And he's commenting on, you know, there was one moment that Foden got the ball, controlled it beautifully. Gomez comes to him and he just kind of lifts it over a little bit to beat him.
Yes.
You remember that little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And like, he says, and of course, here we are, the little spoon, you know, and like, he was orgasmic. The little spoon to take him past the defender, the hapless defender. Anyway, I was like you, I was absolutely loving it. And like, I thought, you know, Liverpool are going to get thumped today. They're going to get thumped. And, you know, credit to them, they didn't. And to the point that you're alluding to, yeah, I did love it. But this is that part of me that I think has got something to do with my Italian football background. Both of those defences were shocking yesterday. Now, you can say that contributed to a wonderfully, what did you call it, open game. Nobody was stifling it. I kind of looked at that and I thought, come on. You know, the goal that they scored from the corner, nobody at the front post, you know, all over the place, loads of errors. Yeah, but there's a lot of errors, a lot of defensive errors, so much so, this is the funny bit about football, so much so, your mates, right, so much so that I text Elliot Richardson, he's a gooner, I say, defences win championships. This is yours to lose, this championship. You know, that's the thing I said to you the other week. You know, you give somebody half an inch and they go, we're going up there and we're going to take them. We're not going to touch the ball. We're going to suffocate the game from nothing. This guy, who won't know what he was doing that day, watching a little text from somebody and he's on it. Do you know what I mean? Like a light. A guy with a million interests, a million worries, a million things, little comment about winning
the defence,
and he's on. Then he says, Havertz, I told you about Havertz, you said he was a bluff, he's on the goal yesterday, I told you about Havertz. Alright, Ellie.
Well, listen, if you can't be excited as a gooner this year, then what are you doing? I mean, it's been... How good is it to have... We had three different teams at the top of the table this weekend, right? With 10 games left, which is just, for all of us, is just fantastic. And, you know, there's no way I would have called the defending yesterday woeful. I think you're being overly harsh. There were definitely some errors there, and that's ultimately how these teams score. Someone makes an error. You know, Aki's back pass was an error, right? And that's how they scored. But I thought, look, credit to Michael Oliver. I thought the ref did a great job in keeping. I think he maybe could have brought a card out a little bit before he did. Kyle Walker probably should have gone in the book much earlier. But what, this again, my dad and I are watching this here, and both of us just in raptures over the quality of the game we're seeing. But
great players.
That high boot on McAllister in the 94th minute, right? I don't understand it, because this is so simple. Anywhere on the pitch, that's a foul. There is absolutely no way the referee doesn't blow for a foul anywhere on the pitch. Therefore, it is a de facto penalty. And I don't understand how this decision doesn't get given, because let's say that Oliver was blindsided and didn't see the foot high. Maybe I can't remember where he was in the position, but let's give him the benefit. He was behind McAllister and didn't see the boot. Surely that's the easiest VAR of all time. He clearly makes the studs hit McAllister's chest. There's no debate about that. It clearly was that it's the 94th minute of an important game. We can't give a penalty. I mean, it's just pathetic. It was absolutely pathetic. It's the one thing that spoiled, didn't spoil the game, but it's the one part of that game. Apart from that, it would have been a perfect game from a referee standpoint, from a fan standpoint, from the league standpoint. It had everything. What did you make of that? Because even in the moment, I was like, how can you not give a penalty for that? It's a free kick and it's inside the box, therefore it's a penalty.
Listen, I think the standard of refereeing these days is very poor. They're not helped with very, very confusing and unfair rules that they've been asked to apply. So it's a little bit, you know, the law's an ass and they're not very good judges. It's one of the major weaknesses of the game of football is that the officials are off it now. You know, the let's hope, you know, that it doesn't really cost something awful, you know, further down the line. But I suspect it will, Grant. I suspect it will. There's no consistency. I'm going to finish still on football, but on this madness stuff, because did you see Lecce, the Lecce manager?
No, go on.
Lecce is a team in Serie B, you know, right down in the heel of Italy. Beautiful city, Lecce, by the way. Anybody that's not been there, been to Italy many times, go to see Bari and Lecce down in the heel of Italy. Just beautiful, beautiful places. And of course, incredibly passionate football team. I don't know what it was, Saturday, Friday, can't remember where games are played anymore. At the end of the game, the Lecce head coach goes on to, you know, at the end of the game, there's a little bit of a stramash and everybody's mingling around. He casually saunters over to where people are pushing and shoving and puts the head on their striker. Boom!
Oh, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers.
Right, now, okay, these things can happen. These things can happen, right? It's like, so it's a man's game, all these cliches, everything like that. These things can happen. The funny bit is the reaction, because nobody is rational in these moments. So this is the, you know, so he was immediately, big issue here, big issue. He was immediately under suspension, you know, and further investigation. And the comments from him and his team were, we need to look at this because it wasn't premeditated. Like, in what fucking world are you going to premeditate putting the head on
headbutting?
But that was the official line. It wasn't premeditated. So I'm already having a real laugh. So today he was sacked, right? He was sacked. He's gone. And he obviously has to make the, I'm reading this now, he has to make, and translating, has to make the call. I'm sad to go. I've got three kids and clearly that wasn't a nice image to see as he puts the head on his opponent. Then he says, I had no intention of doing that. It wasn't in my thoughts. I was hoping to prevent some of my players who were on yellow cards being suspended for the next game. I'll set the example for them.
Oh, magnificent.
And then, of course, you know, then you get the calm commentators that say, if the coach wasn't in the relegation area, he would still be in a job. Fact is, they just gave him an excuse to get rid of him because he was probably, you know, on that shuggly peg anyway. So he's gone. But, you know, welcome to Italian football. Every day in Italy, you cannot make it up. You cannot make it up.
Magnificent.
That's my goal.
Oh, matey. That's tremendous. Perfect way to finish. Perfect way to finish. The old Glasgow kiss. Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, matey, I've just seen the time. We have run long this week, but God, it was fun. Thanks for doing this. Thanks to you, as always, for listening to us. We appreciate each and every one of you. If you don't follow us already on social media, that's a very easy thing to remedy. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's the word A-R-E. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And you'll find me at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. My friend, until next time, Rog, take it easy.
Thank you, Grant. Thank you. Bye-bye. Take it easy.